Dubai Eye
103.8. Time now to welcome into the studio Manal Attiah. Manal is here with us. She's the Director General of the Sharjah Museums Authority, which now manages 16 museums in the Emirate of Sharjah. Manal, thank you so much indeed for being with us here this morning.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Now, in terms of the remit of your role, but more specifically of the organisation, Sharjah Museums Authority, as I mentioned there, up to 16 museums now, so obviously a growing portfolio. What is the remit to preserve culture, to create culture?
Yeah, absolutely. Sharjah, since the 1980s, was dubbed sort of the cultural capital of the UAE, and since then has always kept that sort of name. Over the last 20 years or so, it has developed a number of museums and has reopened museums to larger spaces to accommodate new collections. And it's always been just education at its core. It's all about learning and encouraging people to learn from the different objects that we have, whether it's art, heritage, archaeology, science, etc. So it's just a lot of diversity in terms of what we offer to all kinds of people, and we just welcome everyone to our museums, and it's definitely will continue to grow as there's more needs and more interest that people have.
Is it something that you always wanted to do? And in terms of how you got involved with the role that you have at the moment in terms of curating, in terms of preserving culture, inspiring younger generations to find out more about culture, is there a sort of a pathway into that?
Definitely. I mean, I was the first person to have a museum studies degree in the UAE when I came back from university in 2004. So I've been working for about 13 years now. And at the time, there wasn't a lot of focus on cultural degrees. However, that's changed a lot in the last few years. There's a number of universities in the UAE that have providing courses in museum studies or in fine arts, etc. So it's definitely a growing sector or field to work in. And there's just a huge change. People want culture, they need it, they enjoy it, they love to learn, they love to just have a good time experiencing it and participating in it. And the UAE now is just offering so many things, whether it's our museums or the Louvre in Abu Dhabi or now the new Jameel Center that opened here in Dubai. So there's a lot of great things on offer.
Which is interesting, because that sort of leads on to my next question about, rightly you mentioned earlier, about the fact that there is such a rich heritage for culture in Sharjah, and it's been well known for that for generations. And it's something that each of the Emirates look to preserve their own culture with a view to preserving UAE culture as well through museums. And seeing the investment we've seen across the Emirates in recent times, is there a sort of federal approach as well when it comes to museums?
Oh yeah, absolutely. The UAE's, for example, Ministry of Culture have taken always an active role, but are increasing that role in the last few years through much more strategic looking, strategic, let's say, approaches to what countries to work with. For example, working with France, which allowed for the Louvre Abu Dhabi to happen, for example. And to be able to bring collections from all the museums that are in France to visitors and the audience here in the UAE, but also people who, of course, visit the UAE every year. So it's an amazing, for us, resource to have these connections with different countries. And cultural diplomacy has taken a very central place in all of our lives, whichever emirate you work in. It's very important to make these connections with different countries, bring collections from abroad, but also bring collections to those countries. So we, for example, had an exhibition in Australia earlier this year. So we took some of our material as well as material from the Vatican Museums to Australia, to Canberra, to open an exhibition there. And it's amazing to meet all these different people and have the visitors, love what they see and feel that there is this dialogue that happens when they experience, the history or their heritage and see the connections that we all have with one another. I think it really does change the fabric of your society. I think it really leads to cohesion and a more tolerant society and one that appreciates other people's cultures.
It's the role of of museums changing? I'll explain that question a little more. In the terms that I remember when I was growing up years ago, and you know, a trip up to London was always a big deal because you go to the Natural History Museum and you'd be able to see the skeleton, the Diplodocus, as you walked in, etc. But there was a process. You sort of went round and there were exhibits and that was it, really. There wasn't much interaction because we weren't living in a sort of the economy where technology was part and parcel of our daily life. Is there more sort of onus on you now as a curator, you and your team, to get people to interact with exhibits?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's funny you mentioned the Naturalist Museum because that was the first museum I ever went to as a child. I was, I think, 8 or 9, and I saw the dinosaur exhibition. And actually, at that point, so that was in the 80s, that was considered an interactive exhibition because that was really huge to have moving dinosaurs in a space that, as you said, otherwise would just have showcases and things that you walked around and looked at. Museums today are expected to do a lot of things. And in your earlier show, I heard you talking about stress. And we're quite stressed sometimes because we feel like, you know, we're asked to do so many things. We're not what we used to be. And that's good, definitely. But also we are expected to do a lot more for all kinds of different people. And we always face, you know, the criticism of why didn't you do that? And what about this? And this is more important. And what about us? And it's hard. It's hard to do a lot of programs. But In saying that, we have, I think what's changed the most dramatically, as well as you mentioned technology, is that education and putting a lot more effort into having people connect to what they're doing through educational activities, whether they're workshops or seminars and things, has become much more integral to the experience of a museum. And having people learn in a very collaborative way. So instead of going there and having this sort of, we are the museum and we're telling you what things are and what you're supposed to learn, now it's more of a, what would you like to learn and how can we learn together and what can you create? What inspired you today? And having a different approach to education in general and making sure that children and families learn together, because before it used to be children on their own and adults on their own, and even visitors who had disabilities weren't even thought of or weren't even considered as part of the audience. And now, of course, they're extremely important to our audience makeup and we have to cater to them. So it's changed a lot in what we offer. But I think it's just made the experience a lot more richer for people who come now.
We are in conversation with Manel Attiah. Manel is the Director General of the Sharjah Museums Authority. We're working through a few of the stories that have caught her eye recently. And we go to MinaFN.com first and foremost for a piece entitled Crossroads, Cultural Exchange Between Islamic Civilization, Europe and Beyond, marking the museum's 10-year anniversary. Which museum is that, Manel?
That's the Museum of Islamic Civilization. We opened it in 2008. It did exist before, but in a smaller space. And now, 10 years on, we're celebrating the anniversary, and we are working with Berlin again. They were our inaugural exhibition when we first opened. So it was really nice to have them come again to work with us and co-curate this exhibition, which I think is really important. The exhibition called Crossroads, Cultural Exchange Between Islamic Civilization, Europe and Beyond, is a really important exhibition that highlights how the constant sort of movement of societies and people throughout time through trade or migration, etc., has allowed for this sort of richness in culture and in knowledge transfer and everything else. And it's a really beautifully put together exhibition that highlights different aspects of the key elements of when people move and to different countries and integrate with one another, what can come of that. And it's, of course, a lot of positive things.
It's interesting, isn't it? Something I was discussing over the weekend with a lot of friends, you know, we were talking about etymology and we were talking about the roots of certain phrases that we use every day, certain objects we use every day. And I suppose that's something that the constant movement of civilization is always doing, is that there are elements of our lives that we take for granted, something as simple as a chessboard, a chess pieces, etc. And we don't really, until we have a proper think about it or go to an event like this, don't really understand the significance of that and where something so global originated from.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what's interesting, you mentioned language. I mean, language, the alphabet, is something that, of course, was carried around the world through people migrating. And that's how languages, as you say, certain words, you can find them in different languages. till present day being used. The chess piece, I think, is a lovely example. We have a beautiful object from Cairo, and it's a glass piece, and it's a chess piece. And the chess piece, to most people who don't know chess, the history of chess, but play it, is that it did originate in India in the sixth century, and it moved to Persia, and then from Persia it moved through the Umayyad dynasty all the way to Europe. So that's why in Europe people have started to play chess for years after. But it was only because the Umayyad empire tried to take over Spain and Portugal at a certain time, and therefore brought the chess game with them.
Right.
So it's pretty amazing when you see an object and you think this started, you know, another part of the world, and people enjoyed it. They took it with them. They might have changed certain elements or parts of it, let's say the rules of the game. And then it started to be played in different parts of the world. And then people start to, of course, design and make their own chess boards using other materials. And then you have what you have today, which is very different than what it first initially looked like. But it's a really beautiful way of showing how a great idea or something that people enjoy doing can carry on for
fascinating,
for
isn't it?
Centuries on. So
absolutely fascinating, and we will continue with this conversation with Manal in just a few moments' time. We've got Manal in studio with us. Manal is the Director General of the Sharjah Museums Authority. Nice little text message, this one that's come through from who sent this one in. It's from Alicia out there. Alicia, thank you very much indeed to you for your text message. Alicia says, having worked in contemporary art abroad, knowing how integrated it is into the very fabric of cities such as Berlin, Hong Kong and New York, I'm really, really starting to feel that I'm not missing out being here in the UAE. Sharjah Art Foundation does a superb job. All of the smaller galleries also push their well-curated programs with great events encouraging all. Looking forward to see more of what Jameel Art Centre has to offer here in Dubai. UAE is moving at a very fast pace, and the arts and culture sector are not being left behind. To my opinion, it's an exciting time to be here. That's from Alicia. And I suppose that raises a moot point. We look out the window here, don't we, Manal? We look at the development that continues, not just here in Dubai, but across the whole of the UAE. Is that fast-paced development? And it would be easy if culture were left behind to a certain degree, but that doesn't seem to be the focus here.
No, absolutely not. Culture is definitely at the forefront because people understand how important it is to social cohesion, to bringing about a knowledge, based society. And I think because the UAE is so cosmopolitan, there's so many people, I think it's an ideal place to bring the kinds of shows and exhibitions here to this country, because people enjoy it and they learn from each other, because we do meet people all the time. And we work with them, and we go to school with them, and we're friends with them. But it's so wonderful to be able to show, collections and work, artwork from across the world, that people can then understand a little bit more about, you know, their friends, their neighbors, etc. And I think it really does help to bring a lot of tolerance and appreciation, and everyone to celebrate their heritage. I think it's wonderful.
You were mentioning that just earlier, before we went to the news there, about the 10-year anniversary show at the Sharjah Museum of Islamic Civilization. A lot of people texting in about that. They want to find out more. When does that run till?
That runs until April. So this is one of our longest shows because of the anniversary. So you have quite a few months to go see it. The exhibition itself is free. The museum is a nominal fee to go into. And we're open 8 to 8 on weekdays and then 4 to 8 on Fridays. And you can just look us up on our website at www.sharjahmuseums.ae. All our information is there, how to get there, and, you know, location maps, etc. So hopefully you can visit us anytime during the next few months.
You mentioned a little earlier on in our conversation that you were the first person ever to bring a museum studies degree, qualification to the UAE, having studied over in Harvard University.
Yes, correct. Yes. And
obviously, you've got qualifications in fine arts, amongst others, both internationally and here. Given your extensive experience and knowledge, Manal, I mean, obviously, there's no one better to sort of comment on the importance of a national museum to a nationality or to a culture. And it's interesting, I'm just sort of leading into this next story that you picked up from time.com, the reopening of the National Museum over in Syria, which is an achievement in itself. But I suppose there's both a physical and an emotional element to that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this article by Time completely, I was hooked the minute I saw the title, because I know how important it is for any country, whether it's building its nation, to have a museum is very symbolic of nation building. And actually, the UAE, for example, opens its first museum in 1968, I believe it would have been, in Al Ain, even before the UAE was actually a country. So you can imagine how important people value having a space that they can celebrate their heritage and their culture in it. It's so fundamental to people's connection to their country, to have pride in their heritage and that connection to their cultural identity. And for Syria, I think it was so important because, of course, it's been ravaged by war for 6 years now since, the war broke out in 2011. And it's been really hard for the people there to feel that there's any, glimmer of hope with the situation there being so dire. So to have a museum reopen for them, as it's mentioned even in the article, was sort of a way to say, we're getting there. There is this, we can see sort of light at the end of the tunnel, because if we can, have this museum open and the people, the community can come back and look at the beautiful heritage that Syria has, it will give us, this feeling of, hope and persistence in the face of what we're going through, and hopefully everybody to just, even have a bit of a moment of sort of peace of mind, what I mean? Because that's what museums do. You walk around and you kind of relax and you just enjoy and you look at beautiful things.
It's a refuge of sorts.
Yeah, it is. It's sort of a safe space, isn't it? And it's a place where you can also feel really good about your culture and that pride that you have, and you share it with your children and your family and your friends. And it can be really a special place for people who are otherwise going through a really, really terrible time. So culture can be salvation for a lot of people.
We've talked about culture. We've talked about the importance of national museums. We're now going to move our attention to biodiversity and the importance of biodiversity in itself, especially in light of climate change. And this is because a UN conference has been convened on this very subject.
Yes, exactly. And for me personally, I would have considered myself sort of an environmentalist or environmentally inclined since a young age. I remember one of my first art sort of works where it was a printed T-shirt I did for WWF, and I had printed a panda on a T-shirt and a silk screen, and I did it myself. And I've always been very proud that I've always had this.
I hope you copyrighted, because I think they're using it as their logo at the moment, aren't they?
Probably. but I'm happy it's going to a good cause, because I've always been, interested in this sort of area, and I've always used to watch, animal documentaries and things like that. And I think what's a real shame, though, is that I think a lot of people deny climate change, and I think that is, to me, quite ridiculous, because there's so much evidence to the contrary. Climate change does exist, and since 1970, humanity has pretty much wiped out about 60% of mammals and reptiles and fish and birds, as reported by the WWF. And carbon footprint is huge. I mean, what's happening because of deforestation, but also because of using fossil fuels, has really been an issue. So this caught my eye because it's about how a lot of countries said or pledged that they would also do things, in terms of helping the environment, but haven't really stuck to it. And I think what's good, though, for me, is that I know the UAE is sticking to it. So the UAE did sign, it was part of the convention back in 2004 or 2005. But they've actually committed to reducing carbon footprint by a good 20% by 2021. So that's coming up soon. And actually by 2050, the UAE has pledged to become a green hub for clean energy, which is really also quite amazing. I don't know if people know BITA, for example, but BITA is, I think, the second or third largest waste management facility in the world. Yeah. And that's in Sharjah. And they have been really active in recycling and reusing materials, etc. So for me, I think it's super important that people are just more aware that the climate issue is a serious one. And there are things that you can do. If you go online and just Google 100 ways to, you know, reduce your carbon footprint or whatever else, you can find a lot of information about simple things you can do that my family do, for example. And I know it makes a difference. It makes a difference in our electricity bill. When initially my mom looked at our electricity bill last year, she saw that we were like in the red zone, which is excessive energy use. And she started to put little steps. She just switched things off, unplug things, put the thermostat on a sort of timer. And now we've gone down to the green zone, you know, within a year, which is really amazing how much less energy we use. So there's simple things like that. And, you know, obviously people know about recycling, but there are other things that you can do, just simple things that you can do every day, whether it's, you know, buying local produce or, you know, teaching your kids about these things. And, you know, using reusable bags. I mean, I think I'm frustrated every time I go to the supermarket and I still see people coming out with like loads of plastic bags, and those are not biodegradable. So this kind of thing, you know, they are steps you can make. They're very simple, but they can really change the future of the earth for everybody who's coming after us and is going to have to live in this environment.
Let's move on to your next story, because this one is one that I've been sort of thinking about since you've sent it in. And I suppose it is a definition thing, isn't it? It's all down to the way we define our comfort zone. But until you actually sent this, I hadn't thought of how many people actually say that. I mean, it's that piece of advice you are constantly bombarded with, aren't you?
Absolutely. I love this article because I feel I completely sympathize with the writer, because this article at The Guardian was about, yes, it says, please stop telling me to leave my comfort zone. And I feel like that is exactly what I hear all the time. And I feel it's a message that you find if you go to any bookstore now, today, there's a whole section. I think there's like a couple of aisles about getting out of your comfort zone, self-help books or leadership books or whatever you want to call them. And of course, there are all these people online on social media, whatever you want to call them, influencers and et cetera, who say, you know, oh, to, you know, get ahead and to achieve a lot, to be successful, it's about getting out of your comfort zone, and TEDx talks, and it goes on and on. But for me, I really believed in what she was saying about how there is, I don't know if people know this, but there is information that you can find about this, that there is getting out of your comfort zone, which is the zone of courage. It's called the zone of courage. So right outside your comfort zone is this area of zone of courage, which is, it's practical. It's this part where, yes, you do something you're afraid to do, but it's not so extreme. The other zone is a zone of terror, which is beyond the zone of courage.
Yeah.
And that zone is this is the difficult and dangerous one, which is the one that she's talking about a lot, which leads to mental health issues, which can lead to a lot of stress in your life, because you don't have to continue to push yourself to your comfort zone. I believe that. I know when I did my leadership course recently, which was a 2-year course, it was all about going out of the comfort zone. And it was really hard. People reacted to it very differently. Some people, I thought, we're going to have a lot of problems, actually, psychologically. I think it was really hard for them to do that. Others handled it a little bit better. But it just depends. I think you need to know yourself, and I think you need to do it step by step. And having a comfort zone, I think, is good. But it's, you know, it's about knowing when to push it a little bit.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because we were talking stress a little earlier on, and this is that sort of continuation of that argument. If we are living, if we take it that we're living in a land where there is more stress, or at least we claim that we are more stressful these days than we have been, isn't that part and part? That's where the comfort zone really comes into its own, isn't it? Because that's your safety zone.
Yes, exactly. And it's important to have that safety zone. I don't think every day you should be saying, I've got to push myself out into this unknown, fearful place. Because yes, it does cause a lot of stress with everything else going on in your life. I think it's, for me, I looked at it, oh, the last year, 2 years or so, I've been relatively comfortable. I haven't done too many things different than what I normally do. So what can I do that would be a healthy way to go out of my comfort zone? And for me, it was taking a leadership course. Mm. It was to meet new people, discuss new things, and perhaps be around people who are not really a lot like me in the way that they view the world and their opinions, etc. And that was hard because it can cause conflict. It can cause, you know, be uncomfortable with people's different views. But that for me was healthy. But I knew how to retreat back into my comfort zone, which was my family and my friends, and have that balance of both. But I think pushing yourself all the time and forcing it upon you because people are bombarding you with messages of, oh, you have to do this, you have to do this all the time. And so extreme, I think, is what's dangerous. And you just you have to be very careful about how far you push yourself out, I think.
Joe, are you on the edge of your comfort zone? Do you know where it is?
I know very much where it is, and I'll I stick firmly within it. Although when it comes to sport, I do. I'm quite brave with trying new sporty things.
Okay.
But otherwise, and anything else, no. I'm in
well
that
within
box.
That comfort zone. Yeah. We're in conversation this morning with our guest paper reviewer here in studio. Manuela Taya has been with us throughout the morning. Manuela is the Director General of the Sharjah Museums Authority, which manages 60 museums in the Emirate of Sharjah. And we've got one more as well, and it's that man, Mr. Banksy, as well. An artist, whoever he might be, who, or might even be a she, who knows, who is Banksy, but certainly somebody who knows their brand through and through. More sort of Banksy stories. This is not him shredding art, is it, or anything like that?
No, but I think that bit of a spectacle that happened not too long ago is what's really propelled this particular story. So Banksy, you know, is really an icon, I think, for the UK as an artist, a street artist, but also really in the world. I mean, he's become so well known through the sale of sort of, you know, reproductions of his work and prints, and you find them everywhere. And people pretty much know who Banksy is around the world through his activism and everything that he does. He's really quite intelligent in the works that he has created over the years. But what's interesting about this article, I thought, was how the art world is a funny place, the art world, and it doesn't always make sense. But this particular artist bought a work of Banksy for, it says here, £561,000, and he has pledged to the media that he is going to basically destroy it. So what he's going to do is he's going to just whitewash it. So he's going to paint all over it, and it's making a statement that basically you can't buy street art. Street art is not there to be sold as a, you know, commodity. It is supposed to be for the people. It's supposed to be in the context in which it was created. And I mean, sadly, to be honest, I know Banksy does make a lot of money, but a lot of his work is taken. It's taken off the street. It's cut out of walls and fences, etc. And people sell his work and make millions out of it, and he doesn't get a penny of it because it's on the street, and it's, you know, it's not owned by anyone, or it's owned, let's say, by the building that he's painted on. So it's a really interesting topic about what is the place of street art and graffiti in general, who owns, who has ownership. Nobody should really own this. This is sort of what the statement he's making. And Banksy, of course, also agrees with that, having shredded that work at Sotheby's.
But is he not therefore just contributing to the sort of feeding frenzy for street art by the very fact of spending, you know, $750,000 on it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's kind of I sort of looked at that. I thought, I don't know if you're really helping your cause here, but I think it's a bit of a play on how, you know, money and this hyper-consumerism and what it really means, and why do people purchase things when, you know, it really isn't supposed, it's supposed to be for the people and it's supposed to be free for all to enjoy. But the world has a way of now making everything, people pay for everything, even things that should be free. Somehow we manage to make people pay for things. And I think that part of it, I think, is really interesting. And I think it's an important debate to talk about, because I think there is a lot in today's world where we're just everything that otherwise should be free to enjoy has become something that we've got to pay quite a bit of money for.
I agree. Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that one. This constant want for attainment, isn't it? You know, whatever you think that everything's got a price, so you can throw money at a problem to
Absolutely.
Sort things out.
Look,
we're going to leave it there, but I'm just going to say a huge thanks to you for joining us this morning. It's been great to get you in, get your thoughts, to generate a number of topics and conversations out there amongst our listeners. Manuela Taya, Director General of Sharjah Museums Authority, we thank you. But if people want to find out more, Manuela, about what you do in your role, what you and your team do over in Sharjah with the museum's authority? What's the best way for them to sort of stay in touch with the information that you've given us today and others?
Well, we have a very active presence on social media. So we've got a Twitter handle, Sharjah Museums. We've got Instagram at Sharjah Museums as well. And, of course, Facebook page and our website at www.sharjahmuseums.ae. All our information of all our exhibitions, we actually opened 5 in the last 2 months. So from calligraphy to the Islamic one we mentioned earlier, to art and an archaeology exhibition. So a lot of great things to see over the next few months. And, of course, a lot of great programs on the weekend for families, children, adults, you name it, we have it. So there's a lot of great things coming up as well to celebrate the National Day coming up soon. So please, you know, stay tuned and visit us. And we'd love to have you all in charge very soon. So thank you for having me as well.
Not at all. And I was just wondering whether we can expect any time soon an exhibition of Banksy's street art in Sharjah. Or that must just be a curator's. It must be it's the balance, isn't it? On one hand, a curator be, oh, I would just give anything for that. And the other, oh, no, how am I going to insure it? You know, what on earth would happen?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for me, I think if I had a Banksy work, I know I'd have lines outside to see it. So that would be great. But at the same time, I think I'm for this. I think art should be for the people and street art should be where it is for people to enjoy without having to pay tickets or wait in lines to see it.
This is Dubai Eye 103.8.